Hi, everybody. It's June 2nd, 2021. I'm Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio, the voice of the American Consortium for Equity in Education. Thanks for being here with us today or on the archives. We archive every show over at ace-ed.org. That's ace-ed.org. That's our consortium website. And if you go over there, again, we just put a brand new issue up on the website of our online journal, our official journal, which is called Equity and Access Pre-K-12. It is a 95-page issue. It is incredible, filled with great articles and great advertisers. And if you're in Pre-K-12, you should go over there, read the journal. Everything we do is free. Join with us for Equity and Access over at ace-ed.org. From Fielding International today, we have our good friends Jay Littman and Jill Akers-Clayton. We're going to talk about what they like to call disruptive optimism. These guys plan schools, but they plan schools with education in mind, not just the building, but the education. Would I be correct, Jill?
Hello, Larry. How are you today?
I'm fine, Jill. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you.
Good. Do you agree? You guys just don't plan schools. You plan schools with education in mind.
Absolutely. We plan schools with the creative disruption to make sure that students thrive in all schools.
Exactly. And I don't know, we're going to find out what that means. Good morning, my friend Jay Littman from Fielding International.
Hi.
How you doing
How
today?
How are you? You're sounding good.
Do I sound good? That's good, because I'm a little cloggy
today.
You sound
much clearer than last time, yeah.
That's good, because I've got this asthma, which is making me absolutely insane, okay, even crazier than I was before. So everybody's got to bear with me, and the doctors can't help. I'm hoping an architect can.
Maybe.
Right. What can I tell you? Jill's a senior learning designer over there, Jill Akers-Clayton. Jay is a partner over at Fielding and an architect. And you guys wrote the article in the European magazine, which is called Planning Learning Spaces. And you wrote about something you like called disruptive optimism. Okay, what does that mean, Jay?
Well, disruptive optimism is actually
talk louder.
Theme of
I can barely hear you. Talk into your phone. Oh. Talk louder.
Is this better?
Better.
Is this better?
Yeah, much.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah. So, yes, disruptive optimism is actually the theme of the A4LE's LearningScapes conference in Denver, and it's a term that many people use, and we like to think of it as a way to look at the future through a lens of gentle disruption, because obviously when we design schools, we look at changing the sort of classical practices that you've seen where the teacher basically is the dominant force in a room that they clearly own and have been occupying for 15 or 20 years of their careers, and the children come in basically as house guests. And there's a minimum amount of student agency as a result.
Right, well put. I'm going to ask you something before you go on. A4LE, you know what that means, but most of the audience doesn't. Tell everybody what A4LE stands for.
It stands for the Association for Learning Environments.
Thank you. Thank you. They didn't know that. I'm just making sure people understand that.
Right, now they
okay.
do.
Now they do. A4LE, and there's a meeting coming up in Denver, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, in October, I believe.
In October. Hopefully mm-hmm. it'll be a in-person meeting. Is it going to be in person? Do you know yet?
We're flying out there, so they better be in person. Yes, they're in person. I'm sure they're in person now.
Well, I can understand what you're going, but you're like Typhoid Mary, so wear a hat.
Yeah, yeah Jay. Okay. It's hard to understand you.
Right.
It's hard to understand me. I'm not sure why. I've just tried to put on my my phone mic. I'll take it off again. Is it better or worse than before?
You answer, Jill.
You just sound like you're under the water. Are you swimming?
Really?
Are you still doing your swimming classes today or what?
No. I mean, I don't know why it's acting like that.
I can hear you pretty
earlier.
Well.
I
can hear you
I'm
pretty well.
I'm doing it like this.
Good.
There.
That's better.
Well,
right there.
One and...
Oh,
and Larry,
okay.
to add to what Jay said, you know, Fielding International is really rooted in the examination of the two states that we're talking about, disruption and optimism.
Yeah, that's right. Really
looking at how schools provide a sound and reasoned reference to really move into the future. So we're looking to achieve a post status quo reality where we're really improving beyond what is known of school right now. So we're taking and catalyzing disruptive change, but we're optimizing that by bringing in all the stakeholder voices. We're looking at you know, because we're not the fool who sees through only rose-tinted glasses. We're really looking that there has to be rational action to really look for the best outcome in the future. And so we know that might remain beyond the reach of what we all know right now based on what we are. So our job is really as an educational firm to take all these non-expert voices and combine them together to really create the significant improvements that create the conditions for disruption and optimism about what our children's futures can provide, and moving teachers beyond the current state of affairs, which is a really challenging piece for them. We're working with schools who, you know, some of them think they're the most progressive schools in the world, and they have teachers who are still saying, but I need a closed room with just my students. And so for us, we have to remain the optimist and as well as the disruptors at the same time.
You know, it's really interesting, and this is a key point. Okay, in order to design a school, you folks at Fielding have to understand education. And then you got to think outside the box. Because you're designing a school, but not for now, but also for, not just for now, I should say, but for the future, okay? Because schools cost $100 billion or whatever they might cost, okay? What do they cost, Jay? What does a typical high school cost these days? I don't even know.
A high school is costing between $150 and $250 million now.
Okay, so, and you want it to last.
That's pretty scary.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, yeah.
And you want it to last. Okay.
It's going to last 40 to 50 years.
So who knows what's coming down the future? You know? I mean, we're both from Philly. My high school had already lasted 16,000 years. It was there when Aesop was telling fables. Okay? And, but it's got to – we have to design properly, not just build classrooms and assume it's going to be this way 100 years from now. Okay?
We have to design adaptable environments. That's what we do.
But I want to ask you guys a key question because you keep talking about disruptive optimism. Everybody knows what optimism means, and we all have to be optimistic about the future. Okay, you can define that further if you want. The other word you're using is disruptive, okay? And you guys are the architects. Disruptive is a scary word to a teacher, all right? It's a scary word to an educator. I want you to put it into perspective of the way you're using it. And I can give that to Jay. I'll give it to you, and you can pass it to Jill if you want. So, Jay Littman, when you say disruptive, what do you mean? And if that's too hard to answer, we'll give the tough questions to Jill. So just feel free to pass it over to her.
Right. No. I mean, disruptive is very simple to think about. If you have water and you have some other element in the water like dye, and you shake it gently, the dye starts to permeate through the water. And when we say gentle disruption, that's what we mean, that you inject new ideas into the crucible of whatever the teachers know, and you slowly start to meander it around so they start to adapt. But it's still disruption no matter what. I mean, everything in nature is disruptive in nature itself. It's a natural course of the world through evolution, through anything you do in your life, you're going to make change. It's small, incremental, and over time it becomes large change. And so that's what we try to do. Jill works with teachers before they ever walk into another room, and she's the one who's agitating, you know, the little bowl of water to try to get that dye to move around a little bit more. You see?
And so,
I'm the bad cop.
I look good, a good analogy, by the way. It really is. But But Jill, you're a senior learning designer. Okay, you know education. I know you do. Okay, you also know the design aspect of all this. Talk about the process of going in and talking to educators as you're designing new schools, new buildings, new classrooms, new spaces. And I like the way we say it's not a school, it's a learning environment. Okay? I don't think people would disagree with that, but that takes a lot of change. When you go in, what's the attitude of educators?
Well, the attitude of educators is typically, I'm doing this already. I give my students agency within the space already, and so I typically find that a lot. Or the other prevailing attitude is, I can't do that because the state has placed, and nationally there's a set of standards that I have to cover in order for my students to be successful. And so the significant improvements that I have to start making are in those prevailing pedagogical practices that truly require disruption of the status quo. And that status quo really means that, you know, the current state of covering content and on which the structures we know were founded, we have to be able to gently disrupt that and show teachers that these pedagogical practices can be completely shifted into a student-centered learning ecosystem where students are still mastering and are competent within these standards within a different way and using their space in a different way. And so the power of imagination and visualizing and comprehending and catalyzing that disruptive optimization is really the heart of the change work and change management that I do. And even before teachers get into their new spaces, because if we don't work with teachers on how to use these new spaces,
right,
then what happens is they go into the spaces and then try and use them as a classroom. So we have not created the disruption. We have not been the force for change to really focus on what we're trying to change because we haven't helped them truly understand the way to optimize these learning environments to really give the power of learning back to kids.
Hold on 1 second, Jay. Jill, does that fall on you or does that fall on the administrators who are helping you design the project? Okay? You're saying you haven't done the work. But how much of that falls on you?
Well, in the sense of my role is to really bring together all of the voices together, all the experts in the room, school leaders, community. These are all required because those voices need to resonate. We need all of those multiple disciplines to come in and add voice to this. And then my job is to help them reach that learning ecosystem vision that they aspire to, because most schools already aspire to the work that we're doing. All of that motivational work is usually there, right? Like they have these great visions and missions that, you know, have all these huge, disruptive, optimistic, you know, we want our kids to be global citizens and independent thinkers. But then when you get to the actual day-to-day, the word on the street, no one really knows how to do that collectively. So my job is to bring the integrity of all those words together and make it happen in the classrooms in the beginning. So when they move into those learning environments, it's more of an ongoing sort of boundless, like they dive into those spaces because we've actually gotten the building out of their way because we've shifted those practices.
Yeah, it really does. I like getting the building out of the way. And I got to ask you this, Jay, okay? What do educators want, okay, in terms of design, okay? Like Jill said, they're already doing a lot of these things. Now you guys go and you're going to design a new school, all right, or whatever, okay? When you go in and you talk to educators, what do they want? Because I'm going to jump a little bit ahead here. Okay, they know we're trying to get kids ready for the mid 21st century, and we don't know what's going on right now, and we don't even know what jobs are going to exist. Okay, everything's shifting and changing. All right, what do they, Jay? And you know this. What do they want? Teachers.
Well, to be frank, a lot of the teachers don't know what they want. What they want is what they see. Usually, they want more whiteboards. They want more storage. Sometimes they want a floor that's easy to clean. They don't really think about the education. Most of them don't. And so part of this whole process of change management is to kind of open their eyes up to what is possible. And we do that much more easily now than we did 10 years ago because we have them visit or we show them schools we've already worked on and start to talk about this new idea of learning patterns, design patterns, patterns they never thought about, like, why not have a room that's glass that can hold 4 to 6 kids? What could you do if you had a room like that you could move into? What would it be like if you had a large, you know, like yesterday we went to an elementary school as a good example that we're going to do some work on this summer, sort of short-range work. The hallways were completely packed. And, Jill, this is true. This is a school in Cranston, Rhode Island that has not been renovated at all. The hallways were filled with students from all the classrooms that spilled out, and the teachers had them out there on pillows in the hallway working on projects in twos and threes because she couldn't do it in the room because the room was in the way, because the room would not allow them to differentiate different kinds of project tasks.
Wow.
And so they put them all out on the hall. And you go all over the country, Larry, looking at schools like that are like 1950s, 1960s, and 70s vintage,
yep.
That's what they're doing. Everywhere we go, that's what you see. And the minute we show them another way to do this and how to take the hallways and eliminate the hallways and use those spaces to create education spaces, everybody gets excited. And when you show them, all we need to do right now in New England is walk a teacher group or an administrative group through Eden Park, which is, you know, the project that was in which we talked about several months ago, and the conversation's over. We don't even need to say anything. They look at what the kids are doing. They say, oh, my God, I want this so bad. It's like if you show someone a brand-new Tesla and you say, this is what an electric car is. Everybody wants it. And everybody wants a school that functions in a way that makes the kids happy, that allows the kids to be able to take part in their own education. And then you look at the resource teachers telling you, all the kids I had as a problem last year have no problems this year. And these are real facts that you can go to the schools and visit and talk to these teachers, and everybody gets excited. So we sort of give them a sort of a mini education on the way things can change. Yeah. I think the friction we had even 5 years ago has already evaporated, mainly because, you know, the arc of technological evolution is so apparent to everybody as fast as it's moving that, you know, you don't need to think about what the world's going to be so strange and different in 10 years. It's already changed in 5 years, and everybody can see it now. Plus, here's the other big takeaway. Most of the teachers we are now talking to are millennial, and they rapidly will becoming Gen Z teachers as they enter the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
They grew up
Good
with
point.
This massive
Good
tsunami
point.
Of change, and so the teachers that we had, you know, in 2000, we're still talking about teachers that were even older than baby boom generation.
Yeah.
You know, they grew up, you know, and
That's
they're
impossible.
They're retired.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, teachers, people I've worked with and who were like senior, you know, officials in 2000, they're all retired now. They're all gone.
Yep.
And, you know, we have, like, you know, you're talking with a 35-year-old, they know the difference. You know, you're talking with a 28-year-old, they know the difference, and they know what they're in is antiquated. And I think that's the change. I think, you know, the level of the arc of change is swinging faster and faster now because of all this. So I think the friction is disappearing. And, you know, like I said, this morning, I looked at LinkedIn, and there was a video I've never seen before. And, Jill, you may not have seen it either. It's a stack of blocks, and the guy picks up a block, and he puts it up in the air, and it's sitting there floating. I'm like, what the heck? And he picks up another block, and he moves it on a table, and he puts it on one of the apexes of the cube, and he spins it. And then it says, these are holograms. they figured out how to create a hologram you can actually touch and move. So as you put your hand over it, it reacts to your hand as if it's real. And I'm looking at that going, this is stuff I read about and saw in science fiction in 1980. And here it is now. And, you know, and it's some new component for augmented reality. So I started writing down lists of new like new jobs that are going to occur. And I ran out of room on one page in less than a minute and a half, just writing and then making a network saying, well, if you do this, then all these things can happen. If you do this, all these things can happen. And it's just, it's staggering. And so when parents say to us now, like, well, you talk about all these new jobs. Well, what are the new jobs, Mr. Brain? And you start to give them lists and you see their eyes roll and they go, geez, I didn't know that. Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I said, you know, your own phone, there's three new technologies on it you don't even know the names of, like haptics, and you know, which I mentioned in the past before. And when you tell them what it is, they go, oh, I didn't know that was real. You're using it on your phone right now. You touch that button, it vibrates, even though it shouldn't vibrate because it's trying, or like when you use your phone as a camera, you can make it sound like it's a camera clicking. That's haptics. It even vibrates a little bit. And it's like simulations. Anyone who's listening to this who saw Ready Player One already knows what the world's going to be like because the stuff
movie.
The technology, all that.
I did love that movie.
All that augmented reality is already real. And so who's running that? I mean, think about it. This is the other thing is when you put kids in a room, every technology and every science and every discipline is now siloed in its own little tunnel. And you can't do that because in something like haptics, you need biology, engineering, psychology. How do you teach that to kids elementary school? We don't. But the reality is we're going to be because they're going
to
have to be so ready for college. They're going to need a college-level education by the time they get – they're going to have a college education by the time they get out of high school. That's what's happening now.
We
need to build those schools.
Let me ask you this, okay? You're talking about the arc of change moving so quickly, for things, and everybody says this, we know it's true, for things we don't even know what they are yet, all right? Now, but the onus falls on you two and your company, Fielding International, all right? You have to figure out a way to see Nostradamus, to see the future, okay? How do you design a school that's going to last 50 years, 60 years, it is, all right? And you do this, all right? But with the arc of change moving so quickly, how do you build in the room or the space, I don't know how to say this, for change? Because we know, that things are going to come that we don't even know about. And I know you think about this. Okay, I'll throw it to Jay, and you can continue or hand it to Jill. Okay, but my point is, how do you build this, Jay?
Well,
what do you
the
do?
First thing is that, well, first of all, building technology has changed. I'm in a building right now that is about, it's an old mill, and it has about 2 feet thick of granite blocks and brick.
You're
not going to change that. You know, and the schools we build now, we build with light gauge steel framing and structural steel. The outside walls, because of sustainability now, are built in layers with a composite skin on the outside. That skin can change. Where the windows go over time can change. I mean, those are all things that are, demountable and removable. All the classrooms it'll be stronger. It can withstand hurricanes better. It can keep more insulation, more heat in, more. Everything has to be air conditioned and ventilated now. The building's lungs have to increase, which means the height of the spaces you're in have to increase. The lighting is varied. It's not all lined up in a fixed ceiling anymore, so you can remove and move lighting around. So on a basic level, the nature of the building enables you to make change. But also, the spaces are more capable of being flexible because when you line up everyone in a hallway and then you build block walls to hold up the building that are the corridor walls, you can't make a lot of change. When you have a structural system and you have a learning community inside where there's no corridors and, you have this varied space, you could add another room. You can take out a room. you could build an addition onto the school if you needed to that looked like the rest of the school, much easier than you used to be able to. But the main thing is the small incremental changes that happen on a weekly or, you know, yearly basis inside the building are easy to change. We use carpet tile and floor tile. You can change it from carpet to a harder material. You know, you can change the color of spaces. You can change the configuration of spaces. So I think on that level, we try to build into the design a lot of flexibility. And, you know, just there's an intellectual flexibility in a space where the teacher doesn't own a room. The teacher owns a learning community with six or seven other teachers, and they can plan and plot. I think, you know, a good example, again, is in Cranston, where every space in that learning community has what they call a point zero photograph. And it has all the furniture, which is, well, it means that you have a starting point every day. All the furniture is laid out in a certain way, and the students can move the furniture around by themselves through the day, and the students start to come up with new ways of configuring the furniture themselves. And so they retain and remember a new pattern that they said, wow, this worked great for this presentation. So they all know how to put it back together. So the students control the furniture. The furniture is movable. Yeah. And you can change the use of a space from a stage to a workspace to an instructional space. So on a small level, everything's flexible, and on a large scale, everything is flexible. We can't predict how the large scale is going to change over time. Populations, you know, grow and shrink in size. Right. Pedagogy's changed, but the inside is way more flexible. And I think Jill can add to that from a teacher perspective.
Well, I think our job, Larry, is to find that sweet spot of feasibility, viability, and desirability while we're actually considering the needs and desires of humans who work and live and learn in a space. And so that sort of human-centered design is truly what sets apart our spaces. So when we think about our school in Barcelona, it was designed based on the way and developmentally the way learners communicate, the way learners collaborate, the way they reflect, and the way that they use that communication to make meaning through the learning experience. And as we put together these kit of spaces and create an ensemble of spaces, our job is to help teachers understand and to guide them into how to use these spaces and see their flexibility and the impact that it has on their students. And so, you know, part of the work that we do, again, is really understanding what does human-centered design mean over the life of a built environment, and how do we create those long-term spaces, both physically and with that flexible furniture, that are going to provide that desirability that learners and teachers need to really focus on the learning process in a way that's agentic for kids. That's the backbone of our work, I think.
I love it. I want to ask, you just mentioned Barcelona. I know you guys have done some work in some of the states of Russia and all over the world. You have an office, I think, in Singapore. My question is, is Europe ahead, is the rest of the world ahead of us in this thinking of redesigning schools? Or are we still the champs?
I would say that you have to look at it from the private school sector and the internet and the public school sector. The public school sector, I would say, we're probably overall maybe ahead because of just the modernity of schools. When I go into public schools in Russia, they're not a lot different than ours, except in some cases they're not built as well and they're not maintained as well. The international schools, though, there's many more international schools globally than there are in the United States for obvious reasons, and they all tend to be, as a group, a lot more excited about making change because parents are paying for their kids to have the best education possible, and the research shows that changing schools in the direction that we are moving them in is how you do that. And so, you know, from the international school perspective, there's a lot more going on, and those things filter down to public schools. There's an enormous movement now opening up in Russia from four or five major international schools, two of which are ours, and a third that we're working on right now in Moscow that everyone is looking at, and that is starting to generate across the whole federation, not just Russia, but all the other sort of republics that rotate around the Russian government.
Yeah.
A movement. I mean, even in Uzbekistan, we've been approached now by a group that just formed to reform their public school system more like, you know, an international school might be in the way we just talked about, which is totally revolutionary. You know, Cranston in Rhode Island is an anomaly in the rest of the state. And even though the state government here is starting to understand that level of change and wants to promote it, public school change is slow because it has to happen by policy, which means politics. And the political formulas are very complex. So, I mean, another part of disruptive optimism is how we're slowly starting to work our way into various state governments and suggesting to them that, you know, the very DNA of a school, which is the EdSec, has to change. Jill and I have been working a lot on that. And there's other policy issues that, you know, we have to work out. And so I guess we're doing it through education. We're doing it through architectural design. But now we're starting to try to dig deeper into policy in different states and say, well, what is it that's holding back all this? And a lot of times it's the funding mechanisms of new schools forbid you from doing the things we're doing. New York State is a good example. Very tough to make change in public schools in New York State. They literally have frozen schools back in 1950 and won't budge because of the massive bureaucracy of the state government, which is what runs all the public schools. Yeah, I mean, so they're challenges.
It's nuts. There are challenges, and believe me, we're dealing with 50 different countries when we talk about the United States and schools. It's not that easy. I want to talk about something, Dan, a little more nitty-gritty. We got about 5 minutes left, all right? And this is key stuff right now, the pandemic. All right, you guys were on top of this. We've been doing shows for so long now. The whole idea of better ventilation, et cetera. All right, all of a sudden it all came out. I sent you those articles last week. I want you to talk about, okay, literally designing the infrastructure of schools with health and ventilation in mind these days. And hopefully people are thinking about that. All right, because that is going to make a big difference in how people learn, because you got to be healthy. All right, it's that simple. All right, and I'll just, you know where I'm going with this, okay? So, Jay, Jill, who wants to answer?
You want to do it first, Jill, or me?
You can do it. That's you're the ventilation guru.
Yeah, the
ventilation
man.
HVAC.
Yeah,
HVAC.
Well,
we found last. I mean, part of this, again, goes back to policy. Schools say that you have to use, you know, there's an American national group called ASHRAE, and those are the standards that they use for ventilation and heating and cooling. And the problem is ASHRAE is a minimum standard. It's not a maximum standard. And what we discovered over the summer is that the nature of ventilation in schools, when it even complies with ASHRAE, and ASHRAE goes up every year, by the way. There's more requirement. So what is actually happening is schools built in the 50s and 60s, they're still doing it with virtually no ventilation. So half the schools in the U.S. have virtually no active operational ventilation. The rest are way underventilated. And what happens is that when you go to school and someone has, you know, when I was a kid, if you had someone came in with a chicken pox, everyone had the chicken pox in a week. You know, everyone had strep throat. Everyone had everything.
That's
because
right.
Because classrooms are boxes, and boxes contain the air, and then unless the teacher knows to put up fans and blow things in and out, which they almost never do, everyone in the class gets sick. And then the ventilation system in most schools operate in a way that the hallway is where the negative air pressure is, and the classrooms are where the air is being pumped in. So obviously the air from the classrooms, which is now dirty and germ-infected, is sucked out into the hallways. So when your child goes out in the hallway, you're walking out into an open sewer of
germs and microbes. So everybody's all excited about kids going back to school, and I get that. Right. Okay, but we really get, but you just said half the schools, 50%. Well, what's the answer? What's going on?
Well, the answer is in all of our schools, and we built new specs over the summer based on everything we've learned, you have to really boost up. And, again, this goes back to sustainability and good health. You know, you have to double the amount of fresh air being pumped into a school at a constant level, and you have to double the amount of air that's being filtered through, you know, what we call MERV 12, 13, 14, even 15 filters, which means more air pressure, larger ductwork, higher ceilings because you have bigger ductwork above the ceilings. And so the whole nature of the school has to change to be, I guess I use the word, more capacious. You know, the school has to contain more and flow more air through it. And, you know, the thing that's happened, again, at some of our schools where we have done this, is the amount of sickness that happens, you know, on a seasonal basis has dropped. You know, the fact that, you know, the irony is that, you know, yes, mask wearing had a big deal in all the schools because everyone had to wear them, but the schools in Rhode Island, because of, you know, the articles and the webinars that you've seen and that we've put out and the books that we've put out, it promoted it to the point where school districts in the state, you know, demanded that the state change a lot of these specifications. And a lot of these schools went out and bought fans, brought in filters. And so not only, you know, did they have a very low incidence of COVID in the schools here in Rhode Island, but they also had a lot less colds and flus and everything else in general. And that goes beyond the flu because those masks would not stop a flu virus. You know, it's smaller. So
so what's your prognosis for the fall? So knowing all this, and you said it a minute ago, New York's kind of behind the times. Everybody's New York schools are going back, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
Everywhere schools are going back. Okay, what's the prognosis for the future, considering the health scare we just had?
Well, I mean, it's a behavioral thing. I hear. I think that as we get into the fall, there'll be schools that are probably, you know, suggesting that students, as much as they can, and parents will also be doing it as much as they can, wear a mask when you go to school in flu season. And I think there'll be, because of the success of the vaccine, I think you'll see more people getting the flu vaccine on top of it now than they ever did before.
I hope so.
You know, and I think you'll see low flu seasons for the next couple of years as that happens. But this goes back to the policy issue that, you know, we've been working with SBA here in Rhode Island, School Building Authority, to change the specifications. So we're building a new, and this will be the subject of, you know, some future radio program in a year or two, because we're building a brand new clean sheet out of the ground school, the first of its kind elementary school in Cranston, Rhode Island, in the Garden City section, which was a very, you know, kind of cool post-war neighborhood area that's become a big shopping mecca. Nice neighborhood, getting a brand new 575-student elementary school with all the things we just talked about. Jill's been working with those teachers now for quite a while. So this is really going to be a major case study school that hopefully will become well-known, because everything's different about it, from the training of the teachers to the air ventilation to the system of how classrooms are, you know, changed into learning communities. We don't have to adapt a building now. We're building a new kind of animal, and we'll be building more in Cranston, Rhode Island as well. It's probably the mecca in the state for school innovation.
That's going to be a great idea. I just heard that animal bark. Was that your dog, Jill?
Yes, my apologies. Yes,
no apology necessary. Dogs are welcome on Education Talk Radio. Okay,
right.
Well, that's good because we have quite a few.
Okay. What was that dog's name?
That dog's name is Major Cheeseburger.
I'm sorry I asked. I truly am, but give him a cookie anyway. Major Cheeseburger.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, we used to have a Frank Sinatra, so we like to eat and combine that with our dog's names.
Obviously you do, and we're not going to get into this particular psychological thing, but to check her out.
Thank you.
Do that. I mean, you know, I was once at a I was once at a rest stop in driving in Arizona, and somebody had a cute dog, and I said, "Can I pet your dog?" And I petted the dog. I said, "What's the dog's name?" And she actually said to me, "The dog's name is George, but we call him Freckles."
That's awesome.
And I said, "Then the dog's name is Freckles. The dog doesn't know he's George."
Exactly.
Okay, so tell Major Cheeseburger.
Exactly.
I'm sorry we got off the subject here, but tell Major Cheeseburger. Okay, Uncle Larry said he can have a cookie. He's welcome to bark. Okay, we got to go, guys. We're running out of time here. We will do more, as we always do. You know that, okay?
Yes.
And I thank you for everything. It's great stuff you guys do. All right? And maybe I can
get
out of that Denver thing. Take care. Be safe. I'll talk to you both soon, okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Their shows are so informative. The company is Fielding International. FieldingInternational.com, and if you go over there, they really, these are school designers, school educators, but they are educators, and they know education, okay? So you're not bringing in a group of architects who just understand building, okay? And it's all about learning. It's all about learning, as they said, okay? And hopefully everywhere it's going to be like that, and hopefully ventilation systems, et cetera, in terms of the pandemic are going to be better than ever, too. We'll archive at ace-ed.org. Our new issue of Equity and Access is up there right now. Please check it out. We'd love to have you go over there. My name is Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. We're the voice of the American Consortium for Equity and Education. Thanks for listening.